Southwest Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Victor Beatty reporting. President Obama says Turkey has a right to defend itself. After speaking with Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, President Obama Tuesday urged de-escalation of tensions following the downing of a Russian jet plane that Turkey says violated its airspace despite repeated warnings. Mr. Obama was asked about the incident during a joint press conference at the White House with French leader François Hollande.
Turkey, like every country, has a right to defend its territory and its airspace. I think it's very important right now for us to make sure that both the Russians and the Turks are talking to each other, find out exactly what happened, and take measures to discourage any kind of escalation.
Mr. Obama says the incident points to an ongoing problem with Russian operations aimed in part at the Syrian opposition near the Turkish border instead of the Islamic State. He said it shows the need to move quickly toward a diplomatic solution of the Syrian conflict. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says Tuesday's shoot-down cannot but affect Russian-Turkish relations. He canceled a planned meeting Wednesday with his Turkish counterpart. Liberian health officials say a teenager has died from Ebola, the country's first fatality from the disease in nearly 6 months. His father and brother have also tested positive and have been taken to a treatment center outside Monrovia, along with three other family members. The country's chief medical officer, Dr. Francis Kata, appealed for calm.
This is where we are. The response is going very, very well. There is no need for the general public to panic. We are in control. And I'm repeating, we are in control.
The new cases are a setback for the West African country, which was declared Ebola-free on September 3rd. This is VOA News. Presidents Obama and Hollande Tuesday vowed new cooperation to defeat Islamic State militants in the wake of the deadly jihadist attacks on Paris. The French leader spoke through an interpreter.
We therefore decided, President Obama and myself, to scale up our strikes both in Syria and in Iraq, to broaden their scope, to strengthen our intelligence sharing regarding the targets we must aim at.
The French leader called for an implacable joint response, including intensified attacks, taking back IS-occupied land, hunting down the militant group's leaders. Mr. Obama called the IS group a scourge that threatens all of us, pledging not to succumb to fear and promising victory. The French leader is meeting with other world officials this week to try to build a coalition to fight the militant group. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry held talks Tuesday with Israeli and Palestinian leaders that focused on ways to curb spiraling violence.
I know that the situation for Palestinians in the West Bank, in Jerusalem, in Gaza, is at this moment very dire, that there are extraordinary concerns, obviously, about the violence. And I want to make it very, very clear tonight that I am here at the request of President Obama to see what we can do to try to help contribute to calm.
Referring to attacks on Israelis in recent weeks, Mr. Kerry said no people anywhere should live with daily violence, knives, scissors, or cars, attacks he called acts of terror. Over the past 2 months, at least 89 Palestinians and 19 Israelis have been killed, along with an American student. In Egypt, the Islamic State's affiliate claimed responsibility Tuesday for the bombing that killed at least 7 people at the Swiss Inn Hotel in northern Sinai. A militant tried to drive an explosives-laden car into the hotel before security forces opened fire, causing the vehicle to detonate. A suicide bomber did break into the hotel's restaurant and blew himself up, several others wounded. At least 5 guards were killed, several others wounded, when a car bomb exploded at a checkpoint east of the Libyan capital, Tripoli, Tuesday. There was no initial claim of responsibility. The blast occurred in Misrata, southeast of the capital. Meanwhile, the UN has welcomed a peace agreement signed by 2 tribes in southern Libya and repeated calls for the approval of a national pact to end more than a year of political crisis. A team of international investigators is meeting in the Netherlands to examine evidence from Malaysia Airlines Flight 17 shot down over eastern Ukraine last year. The Dutch Safety Board last month concluded the Boeing 777 was hit July 17, 2014, by a Russian-made missile causing the plane to explode in midair. All 298 people aboard, two-thirds of them Dutch, were killed. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today's Wednesday, November 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenyans are ready to welcome Pope Francis today, Wednesday.
The Holy Father will address the nation from the grounds of State House within about an hour of his arrival. And then the next big thing is the Mass at the University of Nairobi grounds on Thursday.
Manua Isipisu, a spokesman for Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. Uganda's 2016 election campaign enters its 15th day today as we speak to President Museveni's information minister. There are competing claims of responsibility for the Mali hotel attack. And Malawi's finance minister says donors have imposed new and tougher conditions for the resumption of aid.
For example, to make sure that the fertilizer subsidy, half of it is handled by the private sector. Number two, they want us to publish a bill on access to information.
Gudo Gondwe is Malawi's finance minister. A new study finds African women benefit more from HIV/AIDS treatment, and revolutionizing power could save lives and money in refugee camps. Those stories plus Mark Oldman Sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A Kenyan official says the country is fully prepared to welcome Pope Francis today, Wednesday, as the pontiff officially kicks off a three-day official visit to the East African country, the first of his African tour. Manua Isipisu, spokesman for President Uhuru Kenyatta, says the government has also declared tomorrow, Thursday, a public holiday. Isipisu tells reporter Peter Clottey that Pope Francis will address Kenyans from the State House in the capital, Nairobi, shortly after his arrival.
We can only say we are as ready as we can expect to be. We've been planning this over a couple of weeks now. The day is now here. And yeah, we're looking forward. We're very excited ahead of his visit. And the fact that he's stepping on Kenyan soil first as he starts his Africa tour.
What are some of the highlights as he visits Kenya?
Well, the Holy Father will address the nation from the grounds of State House tomorrow within about an hour of his arrival. And then the next big thing is the Mass at the University of Nairobi grounds the next day, on Thursday. And then he has an event with young people at the Safaricom Stadium in Kasarani. And then, of course, he's got the address to the United Nations Environment Program here in Nairobi on the subject of climate change. He's got like 10 events in Nairobi from the time he arrives and then departs on Friday afternoon, headed for Uganda. And yeah, so those would be the ones that we focus on.
Now, security-wise, we know Kenya is battling Al-Shabaab. But security-wise, how comfortable is the Kenyan government about his security?
We are as comfortable as can be. Our Inspector General of Police has said that the security services are ready for the task ahead of them. We can't discuss specific details for obvious reasons, but our security services are looking forward to this job.
What is your reaction to some of their calls?
The fact that they are airing their views itself is a fact that shows that this is a very open society and people can say and do whatever they choose. It's not an issue for us, really.
We heard reports that the president has had a mini shuffle of cabinet. Why this time?
Well, the president has announced a cabinet reshuffle, indeed. As you may be aware, five of the cabinet secretaries had stepped aside to allow investigations into various allegations, and one cabinet minister resigned at the weekend. So the president has then decided to act at this point in time. The two things that the president said is that he wanted to announce these far-reaching structural and personnel changes that will go at the heart of government in order to put a fresh impetus in the government's development agenda and to give the Kenyan public a demonstrable example of his unwavering commitment to delivering on the promises of his administration.
Manua Isipisu is the spokesman for Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. He was speaking with reporter Peter Clarty from the capital, Nairobi. Campaigning for Uganda's 2016 presidential election enters its 15th day today, Wednesday. The three main candidates, incumbent President Yoweri Museveni and his two challengers, former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi and Forum for Democratic Change FDC leader Chisa Besigye, are campaigning in different parts of the country today. Meanwhile, Uganda's Information Minister says President Museveni, who has been in power for nearly 30 years, will not lose to any one of his two main challengers. This comes after Mr. Museveni said a week ago that he is not power hungry and that if he loses the election, he will go back to being a cattle herder. Information and National Guidance Minister Jim Muwezi says President Museveni wanted people to know that he has a life after politics.
The point he was making was that he's not in politics because he lacks what to do. He was saying that he has got his private business, which is cattle keeping, and if he was not in the government, he would be happy to tender his cows.
Now, we hear particularly the campaign of the former Prime Minister Amama Mbabazi saying that he is the only one who can beat President Museveni because he knows all the tricks of the president.
Yeah, of course, that's very unfortunate because there are no tricks in the first place. The president wins on popular vote. That is all. So what the former Prime Minister is saying is not true. And you should ask him, with whom has he gone from NRM? Where is his following from his NRM?
He said he has a lot of his support from the NRM.
He doesn't have. And where are they? Because even in the meetings he has held with Colonel Chiza Besigye, he has failed to bring people he has come with. That's the question Besigye was asking him, that where is your support? He just wanted to inherit the small support of Colonel Chiza Besigye.
So President Museveni is not afraid of Mr. Mbabazi?
Not at all. Not at all.
You know, Mr. Minister, what would you say to those? Every time you talk to people, they say President Museveni, after almost nearly 30 years in power, why want to run again?
The president is following the constitution of Uganda. Is competing according to the law. That is the law of Uganda. Uganda, like Britain, like Germany, has no term limits. So he's within the law.
Is it right to say that everything within the law is doable?
Well, what else should we follow? That is why laws are put in place. And if they were to change them, we've got the structures to do so. We've got the Parliament of Uganda. And if there was any need to change the law, we would do it. But every 5 years, we go back to the people and ask them whether the president and other leaders are still popular enough to perform their responsibilities. And if the answer is in the affirmative, why should anyone quarrel or question it?
Tim Muwezi is Uganda's Minister of Information and National Guidance. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kampala. Today's Wednesday, November 25th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 14 and a half minutes past the hour. Malawi's finance minister, Goodall Gondwe, says the country's foreign donors have imposed tougher and new demands as conditions for the resumption of aid to his country. Malawi lost up to 40% of the budget support aid that it was receiving from foreign donors after the European Union, the World Bank, and the United Kingdom suspended aid last year because of the corruption scandal known as Cashgate. Gondwe says the new conditions include, but not limited, to demand for half of government subsidies to be handled by the private sector, and that the government should agree to provide information to the public about the budgetary process and also to remove ghost workers from the government payroll.
The two that have offered, have pledged budgetary support, these are the World Bank and the EU, have come out with extra conditionality. For example, to make sure that the fertilizer subsidy, half of it is handled by the private sector. Number two, they want us to publish a bill on access to information, that the government should agree to be giving information to the public. And there should be in a bill. We must do that if we are going to get support from them. Then they want us to look at our wage administration to ensure that we expunge ghost workers. Those are over and above what we were given to do before.
Mr. Minister, when we say, okay, what is Malawi doing itself to show that maybe it's self-dependent?
Oh, no. Well, our policy now is to embark on a stringent limitation of our need for budgetary support. That's what we're doing now. We are undergoing some stringent adjustments to do so. But apart from that, we are also, like anybody else, embarking on a public finance management reform program, which is also quite involving. We are also trying to enhance the capability and security of the IFMI system. That we are also doing. So we're doing a lot of things at one time. And some of them are doing it on our own volition. But a lot more is conditionality from our development partners.
The aid Malawi is seeking will be used for what? Money for crop seeds?
We are not seeking aid. We are not seeking aid. No. Don't make a mistake of saying that we are going around looking for aid. We are not. But historically, our budget, like any other country in the region, historically, we have been provided with budgetary support to increase our budgetary expenditure. That is what has been withdrawn, and that is what the World Bank and the EU are pledged for the two of them to continue. But they will continue only on condition that we do those things. So please don't think that we are going around begging for money from anywhere. It's not true.
Gudo Gondwe is Malawi's finance minister. He was speaking with me from the capital, Lilongwe. Malian authorities have asked the public for help in identifying two gunmen killed in a terrorist attack that killed 21 people at a Bamako hotel last Friday. As Katerina Hoyer reports from Bamako, there has been conflicting claims of responsibility from multiple jihadist groups active in Mali.
4 days after the attack on the Radisson Blue Hotel in Bamako, the details remain unclear. Malian authorities say gunmen stormed the hotel early Friday, yelling Allahu Akbar, God is great, in Arabic. Some of the people killed were in the breakfast room, but there were also victims on the two uppermost floors. Some survivors said attackers spoke French. One hotel guest said they knocked on his door, claiming to be hotel security. There were at least two attackers, but as many as 10 by some reports. The count of survivors suggests there were 4 or 5 gunmen. Amadou Sango of Ministry for Security and Civil Protection says investigators are working to identify the two gunmen whose bodies were found at the scene.
Les deux terroristes ont fait un appel à témoins pour demander aux populations si toutefois.
He says more than one group has claimed responsibility, but he will not speculate about which group committed the attack. Sango says when the gunmen are identified, investigators might also be able to determine which group executed the attack. The first jihadist group to take responsibility for the attack has identified two gunmen, Abdel Hakim al-Ansari and Mouad al-Ansari. Sango could not confirm those were the men in the photos released by authorities. That group, Al-Murabitun, or the Sentinels, released a tweet as the 7-hour siege was ending Friday and then an audio message to a Mauritanian news site Monday. Al-Murabitun is a fusion of two Al-Qaeda-linked groups in northern Mali. The group is believed to still be led by long-time Algerian jihadist Mokhtar al-Mokhtar. Belmokhtar masterminded a 2012 attack on a gas plant in In Amenas that killed at least 67 people, many of them foreigners. But another jihadist group called the Messina Liberation Front, active primarily in central Mali, said Sunday in a statement to French media that there were five gunmen at the Radisson and three of them escaped. The MLF claimed the attack as a joint operation with Ansadin, another Malian jihadist movement in the north. The MLF attacked a hotel in the central Malian town of Sèvre in August, holding staff and guests hostage and killing 13 people. The contradictory claims of responsibility for the Bamako attack could suggest a power struggle among jihadist groups operating in Mali. New groups have formed as others have fractured. Membership has at times overlapped. The confusion underscores the security challenges Mali faces now almost 3 years after the start of an international military intervention in the north. Catherine Heyer for VOA News, Bamako.
Treatment for HIV/AIDS is much more readily available in Africa now than it was a decade ago. Life expectancy has increased. But as we hear from health reporter Art Chimes, a new study finds that women are benefiting more than men.
A new long-term study in South Africa has looked at the results of effective treatment for HIV/AIDS, called antiretroviral therapy, or ART, which became widely available in 2004. Jacob Bohr of the Boston University School of Public Health and his colleagues analyzed data collected in South Africa's KwaZulu-Natal province between 2001 and 2011. He says the scale-up of ART dramatically transformed people's lives. Death rates on the whole decreased, and people were living longer.
On the other hand, men seem to be benefiting less at the population level than women.
For example, in fewer than a dozen years, the life expectancy for women increased by more than 13 years, but men gained only 9 years of life expectancy. Why is that? Bohr says more than half the men who died of HIV/AIDS never sought treatment, even though free treatment was widely available. This suggests, he says, that better ways are needed to persuade men to get tested and treated.
Often when a man goes to a clinic, he's sitting in a room with dozens of women and is the only man there. And that can be an uncomfortable experience. And so male clinics are one idea that people have thought about.
Another approach, he says, is self-testing, where men can find out their HIV status in private. Also, Bohr points out that because a clinic doesn't charge a patient doesn't mean that the testing is really free. There are costs, like transportation or missing work, that also may deter men from getting tested and treated for HIV/AIDS. The research paper by Jacob Bohr and his colleagues is published in the journal PLOS Medicine. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
Millions of dollars and thousands of lives could be saved by overhauling the way energy is provided to refugee camps, according to a new report. As Henry Richwell reports from London, the researchers aim to generate private sector interest in bringing new technologies to some of the world's most desperate people.
The global displacement of people has reached its highest ever level. According to the United Nations, 59.5 million people have been forced to leave their homes. Refugee camps are swelling in size, and the resources to keep them running are often scarce. The newly formed Moving Energy Initiative, a collaboration between humanitarian organizations, is calling for an overhaul in the way energy is supplied and used in camps. Glada Lahn is from British policy group Chatham House, which is part of the initiative.
We believe there's huge opportunity to both improve the lives and livelihoods of these very vulnerable people and also help to save money over the long term.
The most recent electricity bill for Jordan's Zaatari camp on the Syrian border came to $8.7 million, forcing the UN to cut improvised connections. But 90% of people living in camps have no access to electricity. 80% rely on firewood for cooking.
Given more efficient cook stoves and solar lanterns, for instance, there could be a saving we estimated at $323 million per year, which would pay off the initial investment fairly quickly. There are even better solutions once you start involving solar or solar hybrid mini-grids, other forms of renewable energy.
Researchers estimate that 20,000 refugees die prematurely every year due to the pollution from indoor fires for cooking. Gathering the fuel can also be dangerous, especially for women.
Women don't want to leave the tent or the hut at night time. If there's no lighting, when they do, they're at risk of accidents and also attacks. Similarly, we heard so many cases of women and girls leaving the camps to collect firewood and being at risk from rape and other types of attack.
Lahn says host countries are often reluctant to provide facilities that appear permanent, but researchers say that using green technologies could save lives and radically improve living standards for the world's most vulnerable people. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
It's 25 minutes past the hour time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Wednesday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports news, we begin with football. Tanzania mainland pipped Rwanda 2-1 as Uganda dismissed Zanzibar 4-0. At the Council of Eastern Central Africa Football Association's SECAFA Senior Challenge Cup in Awasa, some 270 kilometers south of the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa on Tuesday. Consequently, with two wins in as many matches, Tanzania mainland are the first team to qualify for the quarterfinals. Today, Wednesday, defending champions Kenya play Burundi as Somalia Challenge hosts Ethiopia in Awasa. Elsewhere in Bahir Dar, some 320 kilometers north of Addis Ababa, guest side Malawi play Djibouti as South Sudan and Sudan face off. In Nigeria, coach Samson Siasia has included Victor Osimhen, the top scorer at the recent FIFA Under-17 World Cup, in the Under-23 Nigerian team. Nigeria is among eight teams contesting the Under-23 Africa Cup of Nations in Senegal starting this coming weekend. The top three sides at the event qualify for the 2016 Rio de Janeiro Olympics. Meanwhile, FIFA Ethics Committee seeks a life ban on suspended FIFA Vice President Michel Platini. His lawyer, Thibaut de Alès, told the media in the French capital Paris on Tuesday. He raised this alarm, saying this is a harsh and excessive punishment. Meanwhile, the FIFA Ethics Committee, which has been investigating allegations of inappropriate action involving suspended FIFA President Sepp Blatter and Platini, will only make public their final decision next month. Turning to athletics, Africa stands in solidarity with former IWF President Lamine Diack in the wake of British media allegations of inappropriate conduct. The Confederation of African Athletics President Hamad Kalkaba Malboum disclosed in Yaounde, Cameroon on Tuesday. Diack is under investigation by the Independent Commission of the World Anti-Doping Agency, WADA. Malboum, who is also an IWF vice president, insists that Diack remains an innocent person until proved guilty. Finally, for the second day running, some Kenyan athletes have laid siege at Riadha House, the headquarters of Athletics Kenya in the capital Nairobi, on Tuesday. The athletes are demanding the resignation of some top federation officials over alleged corruption and doping cover-ups. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. And briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Health officials say a teenage boy has died from Ebola in Liberia, becoming the country's first fatality from the disease in nearly 6 months. The 15-year-old from a suburb east of the capital, Monrovia, was diagnosed with the virus last week. His father and brother have also tested positive for Ebola and have been taken to a treatment center outside Monrovia, along with three other family members. Liberian officials have put more than 150 people under surveillance who might be at risk for the disease, including healthcare workers and others who came in contact with the family. And that is it for this Wednesday, November 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Shryak, as well as post-editor Demanko Oman, along with our engineer James Hall, I'm James Bartis saying have a lovely day, Africa.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Mm. Next on Straight Talk Africa, Pope Francis travels to Africa, making his first trip to the continent. The pontiff will visit Kenya, Uganda, and the Central African Republic in a pilgrimage that will bring him face to face with Islamic extremism and Christian-Muslim violence. Join host Shaka Sali and his guests as they discuss the significance of the Pope's mission next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC on VOA Africa. Yeah.